You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on Saturday the 27th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. An insight into the Melbourne publishing industry, new magazine finds from Monocle's Hugo MacDonald, and the editor-in-chief of Appartamento picks his favourite in-flight magazine, The Presses Are Whirring, for edition 35 of The Stack. Hello, Tom Edwards here again, filling in for our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, the editor-in-chief of Appartamento, Marco Velardi, talks through how to deal with copycats.
People will always try to, you know, if they see something is good, they always try to sort of take clues from it. And I think it's interesting, and it's of course puts a challenge on you to try to, you know, improve him.
Plus, we head down under to look back on The Public Offer, a two-month-long retrospective of Melbourne's independent publishing scene.
You know, in late 70s and 1980s in Melbourne, there's a really amazing post-punk fashion scene. And at this point, you see, you know, an eruption of different, cross-disciplinary magazines. So this is quite a fascinating moment. And then again, you know, in the last 5 years, you start to see a more image-based and digital culture emerge in the city.
All that and a carry-on full of international reading tips in edition 35 of The Stack. Welcome to something of a special design edition of The Stack. It's a genre that rode high on the crest of the 90s publishing boom and has frequently reinvented itself to stay relevant in the present day. A glance at the newsstand shows many of the sprawling glossies have given way to neat curated journals printed on mat. It's a change that is in part thanks to the vision of one of today's guests. So let's meet him now. Our two guest magazine reviewers are sitting here eagerly waiting to work through a stack of magazines in Studio One of Midori House. The first is Marco Velardi, the editor-in-chief of Appartamento, a magazine that revolutionised the interior design genre. Outside Appartamento, Marco is a creative consultant, lecturer and freelance writer for publications like the New York Times Tea Magazine and Interview Magazine. Our second reviewer is none other than Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald. Hugo, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Marco, I think it's interesting to start so often with magazines, particularly ones that have a very dedicated fan base. People are really interested by the genesis of the magazine, how it actually started. Just sort of remind us of the background. I mean, how did Appartamento, how did it begin, and what was your role in those nascent times?
Well, I mean, it's fairly easy to an extent, but it still has got its own sort of like complexity, especially because Nacho Alegre and Omar Sosa, my two sort of partners in the magazine, they're from Barcelona and from Milan. So we actually, there was only one connecting point, which was Nacho at the moment. He's a fashion photographer in general, and used to come a lot to Milan. And by the time that I met him, I think it was sort of early 2007, Omar and him kind of came up with the idea of trying to do something with the interiors. Nacho, a couple of years before, shot some images for the Vitra catalog, which is, you know, the sort of home collection, the one that kind of gave the start for that sort of everyday kind of look to interiors in the furniture industry. And we were really inspired. I was also very inspired from it, but I found it through different sources. I used to take a lot of pictures at the time. So Nacho was inspired by my pictures. We kind of got together and, you know, through this sort of first connection, you know, we generated the idea. I mean, they kind of had the seed already implanted and you brought it together. My experience was more with publishing. I used to work with magazines in Milan, used to work with Neves Books, which is a small independent publisher in Switzerland. So this kind of connection, the views we had kind of made Appartamento what, you know, what it is today.
And what's the idea to shake up that sector of magazine publishing, which we were speaking just before we came on air about how all the titles, the likes of Elle Decor, Marie Claire Maison, even AD and Casa Brutus had slightly stuck in a rut that spoke to a 90s audience, whereas this is very much internet savvy. It's a bit like a blog. It's much less formal. Was that something that you were quite clear about from the start, that you wanted to give something new and speak to a new audience of homemakers?
I think the idea of making something new was definitely the point. I mean, I agree on the fact that the magazine, furniture magazines industry is really a bit stuck. I mean, because I mean, it's dictated by advertising mostly, and we never had that dictation to an extent. We kind of wanted to be free. But it didn't came so much as a wanting to react to something. It was more like we couldn't find what we wanted, which was sort of more like a natural, organic need of and creation of the project. I mean, we liked each other's works. I liked Nacho's pictures on Vitre's catalog. Nacho liked some of my imagery that I was putting on my Flickr account at the time. There was no Tumblr. There was nothing else. And so from there, we kind of got inspired, you know, from each other. And we created Apartamento as wanting to share the places we were staying at when we were traveling. It was a sort of very naive idea to an extent. We didn't think that Apartamento would become something quite relevant, because I guess to an extent it has become to a lot of people. And it's fascinating because we are at a point where it's like we celebrated 5 years last fall. And for some people, it's still new. Some people still find it today. And I think it's actually touching more people today than it was when we launched it in 2008. This is my impression, at least.
I just wanted to ask about that kind of vision then. As the sort of editorial team, when you sit down at the start of a project like that, it obviously then changes over time. How acutely aware are you of sticking to your original vision, or then reflecting, you know, the interests of your audience, which develops and changes your readership? Does that make you change your process, the process with which you put the magazine together, or do you think that there's still certain kind of core elements that have endured since the beginning that haven't changed so much?
I think that there's a lot of like of the core from the beginning, but I mean, to an extent, I also think that we have changed it because we change. I mean, the magazine is a very personal magazine, so I guess, you know, we started when we were around 25 and now we're 30, and I think it's an important moment, I think, in somebody's life. And I think we definitely acquired a lot of different ideas, tastes, and this definitely has improved or changed the magazine to an extent. But at the same time, when you create a formula like Apartamento, you realize also like that it's actually, you know, quite a formula, so you kind of stick to some of it. I mean, especially because it's important to show consistency. I mean, the readers do want that. At the same time, you don't want to be boring. Over the years, I mean, I think that our very first issue was issue 4. I mean, I always say that, and each of us, Nacho, Armour, might say their own, but I think that the first three were sort of like this sort of creative, I don't know, brainstorming moment. In fact, they are the ones actually you can't really find, because, you know, there were very few copies compared to the rest. But issue 4, we kind of find the formula, and I think was one of the best issues we ever done. And then from there, we kind of develop it. You know, in issue 4, we had a children's supplement. It was like 32 pages, which was kind of a coloring book. Then you had some, you know, different, there was an Enzo Mari interview talking about some of his personal life and his vision on, you know, on his kids. And so it was very sort of like, from that moment on, we tried to bring in different contents, portfolios, essays. We still, you know, brainstorming all the time. I think that's, you know, we have a good base and then we build every time. And the question is always, of course, what are we doing next? In the sense that I think that we're kind of a bit ahead of, as every magazine, a bit ahead of the reader. So, you know, once you're at a point, you're always thinking what's next, when the reader wants to just have that, you know, you already have from the, you know, maybe 1 year ago, you know. So I think, yeah, there is a certain stability, which I think is important. And then, you know, every time it's a very organic process.
I was writing something about our changing notion of home recently. And it was quite an interesting exercise in itself, because obviously for Monocle, I visit a lot of homes and I don't own my own home. So I always feel a bit of a fraud writing what I think our own notion of home should be about. But I settled over the course of a week when I was trying to sort of come up with really what home means to people today, and thought that in no small way Apartamento has certainly spoken to our generation. Apartamento probably together with Airbnb, in terms of opening up the doors to people's homes that would never have thought that they should or could be in a design magazine as an archetype of this is what a home should look like today. Do you think this, you must see your magazine copied the whole time now, because this is what people want to see. Anybody who's maybe under the age of 40 and doesn't buy The World of Interiors to then carbon copy that interior, but they want to have a sort of confidence that the way that they live is normal and acceptable and has its own type of beauty. Is that fair, do you think?
That people are copying the format?
Or? Yeah.
I mean, I think that we didn't invent anything. I mean, we basically, if you look at there were like a lot of like beautiful interiors with a very inspiring, you know, very inspiring interiors in lots of magazines. I mean, from, you mentioned a few titles before, and you know, we're talking also World of Interiors kind of type of, you know, interiors. In fact, in the new issue, we have a long interview that Nacho did with François Allard. So there's about maybe 20 pages with pictures of his own house and pictures from his previous homes. So in a way, we kind of, it's funny how Apartamento's got the vision of like opening up houses to people that, you know, in a way, houses you never see. But we're actually also trying to explore that sort of world of like more like established
living.
And curators. But at the same time, with the notion and the vision of being real, you know, I think that's a key word. And that's what we found sometime in some magazine. There was only one real house or one real content. The rest were just, you know, staged. And that's what we put together. Just try to make a 360-degree real interiors magazine. In terms of copying, I think that I don't think it's that bad. I mean, I think that it's beautiful to know that you inspire people. I mean, Monocle probably has been inspiring quite a few publications in terms of like the editorial.
Inspiring is a generous way of putting it.
Yeah,
plagiarizing is sometimes a bit more honest.
Yeah, I mean, but you have to kind of be, you know, people will always try to, you know, if they see something is good, they always try to sort of take clues from it. And I think it's interesting, and it's of course puts a challenge on you to try to, you know, improving, because at the same time you might realize that if somebody finds Apartamento today, they might not see that you're the original, or and somebody else is not, you know, they just not know it, you know. So you always have to sort of be the original in that moment in time. You can't always be, we were the original ones, we started before. I think it's important. I mean, the challenge for somebody copying is not so much, hey, we've got to sue these guys, but we've got to try to be more original and try to always keep it fresh. I think also with the magazine, it started more from our sort of close friends and networks. And nowadays you see, you know, all sort of people. You got teenager in Tokyo living in a sort of waffle building. And then you got, I don't know, Bob Gill, the graphic designer living in New York. So you see the two spectrums of how people live. And that's, we kind of, you know, that's the power of the magazine these days. To me, is kind of be able to reach to everyone and opening all sorts of doors. We're not just focused on our generation or the 40-something generation. And I think that's the sort of where we are and where we're trying to do to keep it original.
How complicated is that relationship then? You talk about other publications that maybe broadly we would describe as maybe interiors magazines or interior design magazines. How difficult is it to protect that originality? How do you actually ensure that you do that from issue to issue? Because obviously, I guess, you know, advertisers will say to people, well, look, you know, what is your USP on this magazine? You know, I've seen something that I think is a bit like this. What's the kind of process? How acutely aware are you both of the need to be original, and of what your, might we call them, rivals or colleagues in that sector? How do you sort of balance up originality between knowing what the field is doing and appealing to advertisers, all of these factors? How do you weigh up all of those different elements?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the ways to stay original is really maybe not even looking at so much of what's going on. I mean, we've been speaking about how print is dead for the last maybe 6-7 years, quite intensively. It's, you know, it's just been a big wave of this, and you probably say this so many times in your own show that there's so much more print because it's cheaper to print. I mean, printers know that they have to survive, so they want to print cheaper, even like smaller runs. People are more aware of design, so they can create their own thing. It's content with the internet so much more accessible. So, I mean, I think that if you start looking at what comes out and how much stuff is out there on the newsstand, you freak out. Maybe you stop doing a magazine. I mean, actually, maybe that's why I wouldn't say I have a, you know, new favorite magazine in that sense. Of course, you can talk about what you read and what you don't, but it's probably too much. We got to a point that I think that it's actually quite good that there's a lot of print going down, because I think we're getting to a point there is actually, you know, too much. And you're going to use the new digital, you know, platform as well, which is interesting. But sorry, going back to your question, I kind of went a bit around. the point to me is more like, how do you keep it appealing? I think it's also, you know, we introduce a conversation between people, which is something very fairly easy. But, you know, the way we do it, it's with our own approach. So it's just keeping your approach to all sorts of topics.
There'll be plenty more from Marco and Hugo when we come back on The Stack in just a few moments. We'll take a break, then we'll be back with a look at Melbourne's indie publishing scene. You're listening to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Wrapping up in Melbourne recently was a 2-month-long retrospective exhibition of that city's strong history of independent magazines and publications. Called The Public Offer, it was held in conjunction with Archezines, an international touring show of contemporary architecture publishing. We sent Monocle's Patrick Pittman along on the exhibition's closing day to speak to the man behind Archezines, Elias Redstone, Public Offer co-curator Timothy Moore, and Stuart Geddes, one of the men behind risographed motorcycle magazine Head Full of Snakes.
Hello, my name's Timothy Moore, and I'm the co-curator of Public Offer with Kate Rhodes. Public Offer is a survey show of design publishing in Melbourne since the 1950s. not being discipline specific, because we're kind of interested in those messy crossover boundaries. In particular, we should know it's also housed with Archizines, which is an international touring show. So we wanted to kind of have this local parochial archive library battling off against this kind of international discourse in architecture. And you'll also see it in the design of the exhibition. We've kind of taken up the game motifs as well, where you see each exhibition has a different color, blue versus gray. There's a pulley interactive system, gymnastic rings. There's even a badminton court and netball ring. So there's a lot of kind of activity playing off between the different speakers, publications, and events that's been happening over the last 2 months in Melbourne.
Elias, can you give me a bit of background on where the Archizines project comes from?
Sure. The Archizines project actually started as a personal research project. I was collecting all these magazines and fanzines about architecture from all over the world and realized there was all this amazing publishing activity going on and no one seemed to be paying attention. So I really wanted to celebrate that and make it public through this exhibition. An Archizine, as I define it, is a publication that has an alternative approach to publishing architecture. They're responding to what's happened before, and they want to do something differently in their own way. My interest is the contemporary, so all these publications were launched or significantly relaunched after 2005, which together also brings together the first sort of generation of architectural publishing that was really born in the digital age. And it's interesting to see how sort of they are using printed matter at this time.
Now, where have you taken this exhibition on tour?
The show has been all over the world. I mean, it's going to be almost the 20th show this summer. It started in London at the Architectural Association, and it has been everywhere from New York to Tokyo, Chile to Finland.
My name's Stuart Geddes. I run a publication-focused graphic design studio called Chase & Galley. We mostly design books and magazines and journals. We've, in the past, designed Dumbo Feather, Architecture Australia, Mianjin, Monument Magazine, and I've also initiated a couple of publications with friends, one called Is Not Magazine and one called Head Full of Snakes.
A lot of the titles you've worked on fit into a strong history that Melbourne has of independent publications and all kinds of magazines coming out of here, which this exhibition catalogues. When you look at that history there, what are the things that stand out to you?
Oh, there's quite a lot. I have to say one of my favourites is Fast Forward, which was designed and co-founded by a local guy called Michael Trudgeon. It was a magazine from the 80s which came in a vinyl pouch with a cassette and a little printed book, largely a music magazine but dealt with other topics outside of that.
Obviously the publishing landscape has changed rather a lot over the past decade, as we see from that fantastic chart as you enter the exhibition. Where do you see the place for independent print publishing in this town, in this country, and do you see that changing in the near future?
I feel like if anything, it's just becoming more fine-grained. It feels like there's more small press activity or magazines like Collect from South Australia, which have a small press ethos, but are operating on a larger scale than something like Head Full of Snakes. And it feels like more and more of that is happening, and quite idiosyncratic ideas are finding form in publishing, where I was going to say it doesn't feel like that that existed so much in the past, but in a way the whole purpose of this exhibition is to show that has existed for quite some time.
For a print magazine to matter now, particularly in this country, does it need to have that particular kind of idiosyncratic streak to work in newsagents, say?
It has to know what it's about. I think what we're seeing is that general interest magazines, unless they're exceptional, are faltering all around the world. And I think publications that are more focused in their conception and how they pursue that idea, are the ones that are going to flourish. But at the same time, it feels like lasting isn't necessarily the only goal of independent publishing. Like, it feels like there's more of a spirit of doing something and challenging things. And if they only last a handful of years, then that's okay. That, to a certain extent, is what independent publishing is about, is challenging publishing.
Straightforward articles about motorcycles and different kinds of motorcycles and and people's motorcycle collection.
We're standing in front of a diagram now, which is, I guess, a datascape of publications in Melbourne since the 1940s. You should be aware that we haven't been so specific in discipline. So we have architecture, art direction, we have graphic design, industrial design, craft. And we're kind of interested in these messy, blurred borders between the disciplines and how they kind of work off each other. On the diagram, we've also specified the publication by type, whether it's a magazine, blog, TV show, radio show, newsletter, website, or panel event. And we've also tried to map out different themes that have existed in Melbourne over the time. So if you start to map out different trends since the 1940s in Melbourne, you know, you see that the institutions kind of dominate the 50s and 60s. But, you know, in late 70s and 1980s in Melbourne, there's a really amazing post-punk fashion scene. And at this point, you see, you know, an eruption of different, I guess, cross-disciplinary magazines. So this is quite a fascinating moment. And then again, you know, in the last 5 years, you start to see a more image-based and digital culture emerge in the city.
That was the voice of Timothy Moore, one of the organisers behind the Public Offer exhibition in Melbourne, talking to Patrick Pittman. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Stay with us because after this break, we'll continue our conversation with the editor-in-chief of Appartamento and Monocle's design editor. So you're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Marco and Hugo with me here in Studio One of Midori House. We're picking through a stack of magazines, appropriate enough. Hugo, you're going to talk us through some of the things you've brought in. Where should we start with your pile of magazines?
We're going to start with Hype Beast, which references something that we touched upon very briefly earlier, Marco, about the notion of blog versus print. Hypebeast started its life as a blog and then became a print publication, which is something that we're seeing more and more of. Appartamento, unusually, given its audience, I would say, has no print, has no online presence, sorry. Why have you made that decision? Is it just about not wanting to employ 15 more staff to tweet your every movement? Or does it have, do you feel that there's something in print in Appartamento that wouldn't work online?
It's a question that comes up a lot of times. I mean, we also get people to ask why we don't have a digital version, why don't we have a proper website? I mean, we struggle with that, and I have to be honest, I mean, we should probably be better to the readers. But at the same time, I think that we created something that was meant to be on print. We didn't think of anything, and, you know, it was very, as I say, organic, which probably could be also like random, you know, to an extent, something like that. But we never wanted like a digital platform just to have like, you know, pictures of the magazine up there or replicate content. I mean, people find Appartamento, they buy it, they keep it, and they just, you know, it's almost like a little book in a way. And we like that. I mean, also I think that it's very important, and if you want to go digital, you have to really have a point of making that. It just doesn't make any sense to just replicate or trying to replicate something on the content and the allure of a printed magazine on the digital platform. And we don't have a good idea yet. Or at least, you know, eventually the idea could be something else. Why do we want to put Appartamento digital? Why don't we make something that is actually purposely, you know, fought for being digital? We could create something new. And I think that's more exciting than just showing readers how great we can program our website or how much we can tweet.
So looking at Hypebeast then, who has gone the other way, do you think that their digital presence, which was, you know, is still very big and considerable, translates into print and brings something different to the market?
I mean,
it always intrigues me, yeah, when someone's sort of throwing a magazine. What, like, the very first impressions of that? Do you think straight away, this is a good idea what they've done? This makes sense to me.
I mean, I think that it's, if somebody at Hypebeast wanted to do a printed magazine for a long time and, you know, and they did it, I think it's good for them. I mean, it's an exercise to understand how far their vision, how far their content. Because at the end, is it about the content as well? How can I extend? How can I place it here? I mean, I don't know the actual purpose of this. Probably just, you know, just a way of somebody in there that wanted to really have something physical, give it to their clients, give it to their friends, and trying to also, you know, challenge themselves a bit more. So, I mean, I personally don't kind of buy these sort of magazines. I mean, I do read them sometimes when I find them. Sometimes I do buy them, you know, depending on the moment. But I'm not really interested in that. I mean, for me, you know, there's no extra value or, you know, I really look for the content. And I think that's what's important in a magazine these days. It's important in anything, not just a magazine, you know, even in a brand or anything. It's important to understand the content. And if you, you know, they're giving you something, then it's relevant. If they don't, and I mean, I don't know Ibis enough to actually make that judgment, so I don't want to offend anyone. But I think there's a lot of magazines that actually come from this sort of, you know, it's not even backwards. It's a new way. It's forward. You know, it's from digital forward to print. You know, it's you know, wanting to touch it. You know, and I understand it. I mean, how can you feel like, you know, you put news and every day there's like 100 of them, and eventually you kind of start losing them behind. You know, and you don't even remember what you put. This is kind of a reminder, probably. You know, and maybe it works for them.
I wanted to pick up something, Marco, that you said earlier about the origins of Appartamento, the early days when you sort of felt it kind of found its true self after a few issues once it had kind of got hold. And Hugo, I wondered, do you think that's something, not just perhaps in magazines, but in design generally? Are people, I guess it depends on their relationship with their backers often, mm-hmm. do people take enough time to find their particular direction, be it a magazine with its voice or, you know, a new design brand? Do you think there is an impatience perhaps with some people to have the finished product straight away?
Exactly. This is something we've just come back from Salone in Milan that you see particularly with new brands that launch, where it looks like they've been sort of cooked up for 10 years and then emerge as a fully fledged brand. I think part of that is just the sort of savviness of getting the right people on board that people are much more aware of nowadays, rather than testing something, because money's obviously very tight in that industry, beginning to feel it more than most because it's a slower moving industry. But at the same time, I think in order to get a consumer confidence, you need to actually work with them openly rather than open doors on a finished product, on a finished brand, and say, this is what we are, this is who we're about. I think you need to road test it quite publicly, take people's feedback, not be ashamed if you make mistakes, and to be quite honest, and to workshop it slightly. I thought it was refreshing you saying that you didn't feel your first issue of Appartamento really was proper until 4.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think it's, I mean, if I look back at the first 3 issues, maybe I'm even scared of some of the things we put in there. I mean, not scared, but, you know, I'm always looking like, oh, wow, we thought about this when we were starting. I mean, and I'm like, I really wouldn't want to put this anymore, see this kind of content anymore. Or eventually, you know, why didn't we think now back to something like that that was actually very smart, you know? I think that's the interesting side. And it happens a lot with I think the work in progress is something that we are not used to anymore. And I mean, the beauty of Appartamento, I mean, now comparing to what you say about design brand, if you're a design brand, you definitely need to get your things together, you know, pretty, you know, quickly in time. I mean, you don't want to come out there just like randomly with the logo on the wall falling apart and then, you know, a couple of pieces of stools, like, but the stool is not there yet. Sorry, you know, we're trying to make it. What do you think? With the magazine that is a sort of like an intimate and sort of personal, and also like, you know, it still is a personal project of all of us, although we, you know, we made it into a business, you know, it's got its own sort of, you know, distribution proper, you know, events and projects, you know, still like, I think it's, we have the time because it's not a money project, or at least it wasn't in the beginning. So the first 3 years, which the four issues was more like to test it. And also, I mean, to be honest, when we talk about, it's funny, the digital against print, the first issue we did, actually, I never met Omar, the art director, in real life. We only Skyped to each other and we emailed lots of emails, Skype, but we only met in Milan in April 2008 when we launched issue 1. So basically the first time we shaked hands in real was actually when we had issue 1 in our hands. And I was like, what's that? Like, and I was like, no, but I mean, it's like we met there and Nacho was the glue to that. And nowadays, you know, connection maybe has changed even more. Nacho travels some other places, Omar comes here or I go other places. So that's what's actually interesting. We do make the magazine pretty much not digitally, because of course we do make it, but you know, we meet very few times in real life to actually do it. And that's maybe also value, because also, you know, we're not there all the time sitting next to each other, that we kind of like throw small things all the time. When we come, it's like, this is what I want to talk about. This is, you know, how I see it. And we spend, I don't know, evenings talking, or, you know, a few days in Barcelona or Milan. And that's through the internet, through the digital, you know, without Skype, we probably wouldn't have made.
Very modern.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting though. I mean, you know, it's fascinating, the contrast, because nowadays you think this happens probably because these guys, or, you know, all these magazines made from blogs, they're sitting next to each other, you know, all the time. And eventually they're like, okay, let's actually make something real, because people think we just don't exist, you know. And for us, you know, it was the opposite. We created digitally. And then
I just wondered on that point, though, about the sort of the international makeup of the magazine when you're putting it together, you're working with your colleagues. Does that change how you how you consider the magazine. Do you consider it to be international? Is it a Spanish magazine? Is it an Italian magazine? How do you view it?
Well, I mean, we do have a, I mean, you can, people call it all the time, whatever. If they talk to me, they call it Italian. If they talk to them, they call it Spanish. If they talk to both, they call it Spanish-Italian. It is an international magazine, and the, you know, and actually should be considered like that. Unfortunately, the market like doesn't want to just give it an international perspective. I mean, every magazine should have a base, even though you have maybe five offices around the world. And we do have like one in Barcelona, one in Milan, and one in New York now. So which is kind of like, you know, which is, you know, there's not like 20 people working there. It's actually us kind of working different places. But the market advertiser never want to know like that it's an international publication. So where are you from? So sometimes you got to like, say Spain or Italy. It's very difficult, but we did wanted an international publication. We decided English was the language, and you know, there was no English, you know, mother tongue like speaker in the magazine. So if you look at the magazine, these days actually better, but the first issue probably was like a lot of spelling mistakes and stuff. But we still wanted to do it. You know, I think it was important for all of us to decide it was not in Italian, there was no Spanish, it was English, and it was international. It was, I mean, we're a generation traveling. We had lots of friends all over the place, and that was important.
I want to move on to another magazine that is, and it's launch issue number one. It's called Day Job Magazine, printed out of New York. And this is all about day jobs and working. It bears more than a striking resemblance to Appartamento, both in terms of the way it looks and in its approach to storytelling. How do you feel when you look at something like this? I know you mentioned earlier that copying in inverted commas is something you see as a good, viable way of keeping you on your toes and pushing forward. But to me, that seems just a little bit lazy, like it's trying to piggyback on what you do.
Well, I mean, again, I don't like to sort of talk bad about anyone. And I, you know, the other thing also I like about magazine is that I would never really, people are obsessed with issue one all the time, but I think that you should always wait. I would never really consider a magazine until I see issue three. You know, it's like, it's always really important to see how they develop. I mean, it's easy to put your friends in it in the first issue. You probably play your best card because you want to be out there, you know, your best techniques or whatever. You really see what a magazine is after three issues. And that's, you know, maybe it came also by making Appartamento. That was a, you know, good sort of learning process. So maybe, Day Job Magazine just got some clues, you know, and they want to experiment. And eventually by issue three, they're totally different. So now we're criticizing them because eventually they look the same. Some people make comments, but I mean, how many things looks the same nowadays? I mean, it's unfortunate, but sometimes it's because, you know, you look too many blogs and too many magazines, you're inspired, and eventually you want to try that, you know. It's a trial and error, and I think it's really important. I mean, when we do workshop with Omar sometime on different sort of universities, we do a workshop on magazines, and we do like sort of a magazine. We don't do graphic design magazine. We actually want them to develop the content, to develop the editorial, you know, the structure. And that's the most important. And actually ask them what they think the magazine will evolve into it in a few issues. So, you know, it's lots of students have to, or people anyway, they have to make a trial and error. You know, they've got to make mistakes. Maybe they look at something too much in the first issue, but the second one and third actually develop their own ideas because they started from somewhere. I'm sure Appartamento, now Omar will hate me, but took some clues somewhere eventually. Or, I mean, of course, Omar, you invented everything, but like, you know what I mean? It's, you know.
I know what you mean. A slightly sort of tangential question actually on Day Job Magazine. Going back to what you were saying about the way that you work, which is very unusual, but maybe the future. Do you think that we're all, I mean, the content of this magazine, which is about work and jobs, is that becoming a bigger part of our lives, sort of looking at the way that we work and thinking we're stuck in a rut? We went from being white collar, blue collar office workers. Suddenly we now have the opportunity that technology brings to be properly mobile and still do really whatever we want to do.
Well, I mean, I think that it's a definitely different generation from my parents, at least that they, you know, worked all their life into one place and they, you know, they were there all the time and have to be there all the time. It's funny because one of the things that came up at Salone this year was definitely innovation, the future of everyday. There was a lot of discussion about this and how technology would integrate our everyday and work-life relationship, I mean, which is one of the big struggles that office furniture companies have to reinvent the office. I mean, one is a commercial point of view. They've got to sell new furniture. Second, you know, people are shifting. They're working in a different way. So I think definitely, I mean, it's maybe I went off a bit the question, but I mean, the idea is definitely that we're changing, and it's much more easier to do things from all over the place. I mean, as I said, Apartamento, it's a publishing house and it's a project, but we all do our own things. I mean, Omar, you know, designed the floss stand, you know, this year, for example, at the Euroluce. I work with the Padova. Nasha works for a lot of fashion magazines, you know, also shoots advertising. So all these things, you know, are part of our life. At the same time, we sit down at the computer and we make Apartamento, or, you know, we meet and exchange. And all these experiences outside, all these sort of like day jobs, actually, they bring back a lot of energy back into the magazine, because we can explore so many worlds. If we were sitting there and just do the magazine or do something else, eventually we would not have all these experiences.
It's fascinating stuff. Marco, Hugo, we're going to be talking a little bit more about maybe the evolution of the publishing business right after this. So you're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Let's continue. Let's look a bit about then the media that I guess you're consuming all the time. Marco, what are some of the things that you would read? You know, your habitual reads. Are there things that you never like to miss, or things that you read occasionally, weekly? What are the usual stopping points for you with your printed products?
It might be weird to say, but actually I do read the Financial Times weekend. Pretty much every weekend, I would say. Because of, like, you know, I really like, first of all, I got used to it because I study in England, and eventually from that, I kind of got the habit to buy it on a weekend. And also because I cannot find any very good newspaper supplement in Italy, or, you know, like newspapers, Sunday newspapers. So the Financial Times is the easiest to get. It's got enough content to read it through the week. Sometimes actually they pile up and I never read them, but still, you know, I enjoy buying that. And, you know, and the good thing of coming to UK actually is that you get the actual magazine here, which you don't get in Italy. And I think that's the kind of publication that interests me the most these days. I mean, I used to read a lot when they relaunched Bloomberg Businessweek. Nowadays, I have just the iPad. Actually, I read it on the iPad, and actually it's easier because the subscription never worked. I probably got 2 copies out of 50 that I was supposed to get. So I decided to stay digital, and every now and then I buy it in the airport. But it's that kind of sort of reading that I think it's much more relevant to me these days. I mean, and going back to what we say with Hugo before, I think it's also because the independent magazine publishing is kind of getting a bit stuck to me in terms of like the concept, the ideas and the design. So, I mean, there's beautiful magazines out there. I could make a list of, you know, magazine that I like, but what's more relevant on an everyday sort of basis, on also developing my topics. I mean, if you look at how the Financial Times supplement talks about food, the arts, you know, anything, book reviews or culture, I think it's very good mix. And I also read it because I wish it would come back to Italy at some point, although I think it's going to be very hard that we get a really good newspaper supplement.
Why is that? Because there are some fantastic supplements, or notorious supplements, that have undergone relaunches, and Omar himself redesigned Casamica, which took quite wide acclaim. I love it.
Yeah, we did it together in 2010. I mean, we got on the job together, and me more on a sort of in between editorial and creative direction, and Omar more like on the art direction as well. And also with my partner from Milan, from my studio, like Davis, we sort of did it together. Now Omar is running for the last couple of years because, I mean, he stayed on the job, we move on to something else. But that was a really interesting process, and I think that was something that I was looking forward to it. But I mean, at the same time, I would say that, you know, those things kind of get stuck. They're kind of nice, you know, at some point, but then eventually, you know, the publisher kind of lose interest. I mean, if you see in Italy, it's all about the relaunch. It's not really so much about sustainability and continuing the actual quality of the magazine. I mean, if you look at also, I don't know, now somebody probably, you know, I have to watch out when I go back. But, you know, if you look at like Di della Repubblica, I mean, I think they just relaunched it, but I think it just stuck, you know. It's not so much stuck with the design. I don't want to pinpoint something specific, but I think that it doesn't feel fresh when you get it in your hand. It doesn't really, you know, maybe the target is not me, but still I think it's a shame. Such a powerful entity like La Repubblica is not able to bring out something, you know, it doesn't have to be this, you know, very thick. It can be very light, you know, very few pages, and still quality, small, you know, things you want to read during the week. And I think that's what's missing there. I mean,
it's interesting. I wonder, you mentioned a couple of times, you said some of these big papers, they get a little stuck. Sometimes in the independent magazine sector, there's a tendency for things to get stuck. What do you think the problem is with that? Is that a lack of editorial sort of inspiration? Do we maybe lack some of those big character editors, maybe, who are often the drivers behind those projects? What do you think are the reasons why that sort of stuck problem happens?
In both, you mean independent and also commercial? I mean, from the independent perspective, I think that as I said before, I think with the digital culture, like Tumblr, all this sort of editing or digital editing platform, everybody thinks they can edit something. They can put together a few pictures and wow, you know. First of all, like on the internet, rights and all those things, you know, it's like sometimes you just acquire images without knowing how to get them, you know, where they're coming from. But I think once you get onto print, it's a whole different game, you know. And a lot of people kind of fail, especially in independent magazine, because they eventually get stuck. Everybody uses the same kind of content. They just don't innovate. They don't look for the side of it. I mean, and some people might say Apartamento might have some problems with that. But I mean, you know, I'm just saying the independent, you know, eventually you need to always broaden, you know, the your reach and have good editors. I think that's one of the points we're trying to achieve with Apartamento is definitely, you know, I mean, I've taken some clues from the Financial Times. I asked Nicholas Lander to write a few times for us. And I think that's the challenge, you know, also like authors of books. People never think you read the book. You could find an email and write them and ask them to write something. And I think that we're kind of all very limited. The indie community stays very limited. I mean, there's really good magazines, but I'm not saying just all of them. But that's probably one of the problems for a big chunk of it. In terms of like the mainstream newspapers, I mean, I don't have a huge knowledge of that. But I think that it's, I feel as a sort of 30-something consumer that likes media and likes to read and reads English and reads, you know, my own language, Italian. There's nothing in Italy beside maybe, I don't know, Il, as I met from Sole 24 Ore, that really gives you that sort of broad spectrum. It's, you know, and even Il is very focused to an extent. I want something that is generic but talks about food and, you know, also music, the same sort of like, you know, view and understanding and being open and not just being stuck to the same all the time.
Relating that back to Salone del Mobile and the big Italian furniture manufacturers, it strikes me as being a lack of confidence that the older generations have in trusting young people with new ideas that seem radical when they just don't want to take any risk at all. And they feel like actually sticking to the same path, maybe with one or two tweaks to designs here or there, be it in print or in furniture production, is safer than throwing everything out and starting again from scratch and maybe might fail, but it might be a huge success. Yep. I mean, you're quite a rare example of a young person who, working in the creative industries, has done very well in Italy. Do you think, is this a downward spiral that we're just going to see continue, or is it going to reach a point where older furniture manufacturers, older publishers are going to suddenly say, actually, we need to start trusting young people again?
I think that, I mean, we spoke about this a year ago briefly, and I think it's, I was more optimistic last year, actually, about this, but I think it just, you know, getting older maybe sometimes. But I think that, well, Italy's not in good shape at the moment. If you look at what happened, you know, Napolitano got reelected. I mean, how can a country just be so stuck? I mean, nothing to say against him or the system, but we're definitely stuck. I didn't expect that 1 year ago, although maybe some people would. I think that in terms of the furniture industry, there's a lot of second generation in place at the moment or soon to be in place, which eventually kind of don't have the same drive as the first sort of generation. So that's also the problem. Sometimes, you know, if the business went well up to now, you know, sometimes you're a bit, you know, shaky. You don't want to invest in young energy because sometimes young energy could be disruptive to an extent. I don't know if Italian manufacturers will eventually trust. I think that there's a few opportunities. I mean, I feel very blessed in that because with the Padova, also with Corriere della Sera, when they asked us to do Casa Amica, I mean, eventually they saw the light into young people doing something new for them. But it's not, you know,
it's
normal.
The exception rather than
yeah,
the rule.
I think it is. And it will stay like that for at least for a while. At the same time, you know, you got to keep trying and pushing, and that's what I'm doing. And there's a lot of young people in Milan who's actually doing and trying to do that, you know, pushing for, you know, reaching eventually that sort of point where they can also shape bigger things. I don't think we'll really change as fast as in England or other places.
Do you see young independent magazines coming out of Italy?
Yeah, there's a few. There's actually issue 2 just came out, and to be honest, actually, it's Friends, but I haven't really looked at it properly. It's a food magazine. It's a bit more of a fashion food magazine. It's called Alla Carta. I mean, eventually, I mean, I think that it's three girls doing the magazine, and I think they have got the right probably ideas and energy. I used to work with one of them before on a previous publication, and I think, you know, they probably have the good ideas. I think they still need to shape it and, you know, put everything into place. And I think also they do it as a hobby. I don't think they do it full time. So that's sort of part of the beauty. There is like a studio, which is fairly interesting. I think they relaunched recently. And I think, you know, there's young people behind as well. I mean, I don't actually, you know, spend much time with it, but I think it's still nice to see that people are working on that. And then you have Moose and Kaleidoscope, which are two art magazines. And I think they're actually quite interesting. They do push the sort of the boundaries for that kind of genre of magazines, not just in Italy, but kind of on a European scale. So I think there is a very good energy, but it stays pretty much, you know, besides Studio, which is maybe, you know, trying to be Italian and a bit more mainstream, it kind of stays there, you know. It would be nice if they could find a big publisher that eventually invests or like Appartamento, in a way, in 5 years, eventually you reach a point where you become a bit more, you know, successful and can do something else.
I wanted to ask you about that kind of progression. What does the future hold then in the sort of medium or even longer term, looking ahead for Appartamento? I mean, is it the kind of thing where, you know, if a big investor said, look, you know, we've charted your progress, we love what you do, we'd like a piece, or, you know, is that something you'd entertain, or is it something that's too personal for you, perhaps?
No, I mean, I think that I cannot speak for all of us, you know, because, of course, it's like, it's not just me. I think it's it could be a very interesting opportunity. It would have to be the right opportunity, though, because I think that with magazines like Appartamento, sometimes it's better to actually, my personal view is actually to let it, you know, disappear or kill it when it's actually at the best, you know, then try to sort of put somebody in or get enough money to make it too big and uncontrolled, you know. I mean, I want to wake up in 20 years and think that I did something very nice, not that eventually something went wrong down the line. But eventually, I mean, I'm sure there's, if you get the right investor, the right person, it could be very interesting to get a boost and create something, which is not just, as we say before, you asked me about digital. Eventually, the investor doesn't have to come for the physical Appartamento. We could have someone that eventually will help us develop our ideas on a digital platform and create something that spins off from there. So investor doesn't have to be just, okay, I buy the magazine and we print triple. I think it could be a very interesting challenge if somebody approaches.
And you really mean that about letting something sort of fade away from its greatest moment? You don't think there's something maybe a little sad about, you know, letting go of something when it's still really great?
Well, I mean, to an extent, but, you know, I think that it's important not to sort of, compromise and sell yourself, especially because, as I said, we live off Appartamento, but not really. I mean, we do other things. Appartamento is still like a love project. I think that, you know, could be very interesting to see new challenges with somebody putting a certain investment in there. But again, as I said, the investment should be something that I feel comfortable enough not to wake up in 20 years and feel like, what did we do?
That's always a good idea, I think.
Yeah. Knowing when to let go is always very important.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also like, it's not cheating on your reader, which is very important. And I think it's, as I said, the reader is the most important thing. And that's why I think, going back to the newspapers in Italy, even the newspaper themselves, I think they have issues. Maybe besides Sole 24 Ore, which is still very niche to an extent. I think they should sort of like listen more to the reader. I mean, when we did Casamica, my struggle was a lot. And I think the editor, Silvia Robertassi, is still there. She really understood that we had to speak to the reader, not just to the advertiser. But of course, you know, the advertisers actually, you know, control the game in such a big, sort of commercial publication. But I think the newspapers and newspaper supplements and magazine, they should really listen to the reader and stop compromising with advertising, which I think it's really what's killing the industry at that level, especially.
I just wonder then, when you sort of, you're traveling around extensively, a lot of very kind of creative people in these kind of industries, are there particular places in the world where you go and say, hey, you know, these people really get this. They've really got a good model here, be it for managing their media or for encouraging, you know, the younger entrepreneurs to get into publishing. Are there some places particularly you think are doing it really well? Or do you find that it's the same thing? It's a mix everywhere of good and bad?
I think that, I mean, definitely more like, Northern Europe sort of has got a bit more of an understanding. I mean, the more southern you come to Europe, I think the less of that. I mean, in Italy, media is like kind of, you know, it's kind of like sometimes even controlled, you know, too much. I would say like my impression, I mean, I wouldn't say, let's say Sweden is an easy maybe explanation where people can eventually, you know, meet really interesting people there and, you know, maybe not so much in the media industry themselves, more like in other businesses. But England is interesting as well. I think that definitely much better platform actually to play with than Italy itself. And I mean, I love Italy. I don't want to sound like the title would be like, what went wrong with Italy, you know, like of the show. But I mean, at the end of the day, I think in general nowadays, we see pretty much a good mix everywhere. I mean, especially there are pockets of people that eventually understands the media industry, understands how to work in a certain way, and they do have the international connection which are needed for making those projects happen. So pretty much you could feel home everywhere. Some places are better than others, as usual, but I think it's, you know, because I'm in Italy. Maybe if I come here, I would say the opposite in a few years. I don't know.
It's very easy to hate your own doorstep.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, are there any other magazines we should mention? Hugo, is there any others that you want to delve into?
Well, something caught my eye that came through. It's by Norwegian, which is Norwegian Airlines in-flight magazine, and has had a very good redesign, in my opinion. Obviously, the airline is expanding very, very rapidly indeed. This is not an in-flight magazine as one would expect to see it. It's very beautifully put together. It has a completely global appeal, a nice breakdown of sort of long form pieces, a lot of infographics, but not too many infographics, which can be a problem, and something that people seem to be a little bit hooked on at the moment. I wondered if you've seen this and if you're...
I actually didn't see this issue, but I think that... What's interesting about this, first of all, I love in-flight magazines, and many go really bad. Like if you look at Ulisse from Alitalia, it's like it's appalling. I mean, and Alitalia is actually doing not too bad. I mean, I saw they relaunched their website the other night. I mean, I don't know if it's good or bad, but the image is actually not too bad. But, you know, with the magazine, it's awful. I think this one seems really interesting. I think there's a few airlines that do well. Even SAS, for example, although maybe the airline doesn't do so well, but Scanorama is not so bad. I mean, and what's interesting about this, since you mentioned it, is that there's a lot of like sort of company magazine that getting on the newsstand. I mean, I don't know about this if you can buy it, but if you look at Scanorama, you could buy it in Sweden. They have also like a special, I don't know, quarterly version. Vitra just did the workshop, is actually on the newsstands. So it's very interesting how now we're seeing a lot of these sort of brands investing into this sort of publication eventually get on the newsstand. And I think this is an interesting future, sort of the MOOC or company magazine kind of infiltrating the system,
exactly.
Which is very Japanese to an extent. There's a lot in Japan and maybe exists in other countries. But I see a trend in that, more than independent magazine. Maybe these are more interesting for me these days. But this seems really nice. I mean, I haven't looked at it, but...
I mean, it all comes back to that same thing of investing in the quality of the things that you put in or the quality of your product. I mean, content is the word that I don't like particularly, but the content there is very, very high, and it's definitely as high, if not higher, than a lot of...
On the average of the market, yeah.
Exactly, magazines that you would buy on a newsstand rather than just throwing together something printed for people to have a look at on their flight between London and Oslo. It's a proper magazine that has more... in it that I would be interested to read than many consumer magazines at the moment.
I'm very curious about one last point about airline magazine, how relevant is still going to be in a few years, because it's a big question. I always see this magazine and it says, please take me with you, but then eventually, you know, how many people take them, how many get ruined, how many do they need to print, is that sustainable? So at the same time, I'm very curious how that segment of the market will eventually develop, if it's going to be something digital, what you're going to get, or... and, you know, especially nowadays, like Norwegian, they give you free Wi-Fi on the actual flight. So that's an interesting market or segment of the media market to look at, how it's going to evolve.
We'll have to get you back, Marco, and you can, maybe in a year or two's time, we can see whether you've been, whether we were right or wrong about where it was going.
Well, I thank you.
Fascinating stuff. Marco and Hugo, thanks very much for joining me on the Stack today.
Thank you very much.
And that brings us to the end of edition 35 of The Stack. My guests today have been the editor-in-chief of Appartamento, Marco Velardi, and Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald. My thanks to them both. Our producer today was Adrian Craddock, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. If you've got any comments or queries, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And don't forget, we'll be back next Saturday at the same time. Of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, goodbye. Thank you.